Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Philosophy channel of the New Books Network. My name is Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I'm co-host of the channel, along with Carrie Figner, who is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. In our bi-monthly podcast, we talk to philosophers about their newly published books. Today, my guest is Kimberly Brownlee. We will be talking about her new book, Conscience and Conviction, The Case for Civil Disobedience, which was just published by Oxford University Press. Kimberly Brownlee is associate professor in legal and moral philosophy at the University of Warwick. When confronted with a law that they find morally unconscionable, citizens sometimes engage in civil disobedience. They publicly break the law with a view to communicating their judgment that it is unjust. Citizens in similar situations sometimes take a different stance. They engage in conscientious objection. They quietly disobey, seeking only to keep their own conscience clear. A common view of these matters has it that the conscientious objector is deserving of special respect and even accommodation, whereas the civil disobedient engages in a politically risky and morally questionable practice. In her new book, Kimberly reverses this picture. She contends that properly conducted civil disobedience is more deserving of accommodation and respect than conscientious objection. Her case turns on a detailed and subtle analysis of the very concepts of conviction and conscience. This is a challenging and elegantly argued book. So let's turn now to the interview. Hello, Kimberly Brownlee.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing today?
I am fine. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, thank you for joining us. Today, folks, on New Books in Philosophy, my guest is Kimberly Brownlee. Her new book is titled Conscience and Conviction, The Case for Civil Disobedience, and it's just been published by Oxford University Press. Now, as the title of the book suggests, this book is a detailed examination and defense of civil disobedience. I recommend it highly to those interested in political and legal philosophy, of course. But the book will also be of interest, I think, to moral philosophers more generally, especially given that Kimberly offers several analyses of important moral concepts, including the idea of moral conviction. But before we get into the details of the book, Kimberly, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write it?
Okay, thanks, Bob. So just to give you a bit about my background, I'm Canadian. I grew up in the Fraser Valley, which is just outside Vancouver. And I'd always been interested in big questions like, you know, who are we and how should we live? But I didn't know that there was a discipline, philosophy that looked at these questions until probably the final years of high school, when I did the International Baccalaureate program. And in that program, there's a compulsory theory of knowledge course. And, like many people who sort of end up in a field, you know, they talk about there was a special teacher in the background. And that was certainly true for me, that the man who taught theory of knowledge, he was entirely irreverent in his teaching methods. So we would hold classes on the roof of the building. we would hold classes where we all faced the outer walls instead of each other to see if this would somehow enhance discussion. He was very fond of saying at disconcerting moments, "How do you know?" And he was very inspiring as someone just wholly animated by big ideas. And from him, you know, I learned about some of the, you know, interesting thought experiments, Nozick's utility monster, Nozick's experience machine, the idea of a brain in a vat, and I was absolutely hooked. And from there, I went on to study philosophy at McGill, and then at Cambridge, and then at Oxford. And the book project started life about 10 years ago as the focus of my D-field dissertation. And I think what led me to this topic, the topic of civil disobedience, there were two things. One was a real fascination with the lives of people like Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., Nelson Mandela, more recently Aung San Suu Kyi, these people who seem to embody a certain kind of wise integrity, who were willing to be, you know, entirely self-exposing in honoring a great cause. You know, someone like Gandhi, you know, was able to say fairly truthfully, "My life is my message." And so there's, you know, there's a somewhat romantic starting point, but really wanting to understand what was it to be that kind of wise being, and, you know, sort of how did that fit into a broader picture of the way we should live? And the second interest related to something of a psychological question of why do we show deference to people who assert conscience, people who claim to be animated by a deep conviction, because it's not just the great characters like, you know, Gandhi and King and Aung San Suu Kyi that we respect. We tend to be quite deferential to, you know, the doctor who just refuses point blank to perform abortions, or the civil registrar who refuses categorically to perform same-sex marriage ceremonies. We tend to be very responsive to this. And we tend to look to see whether there's a consistency between what these people say and how they behave. And when we see one, you know, when we see them sort of putting their money where their mouth is, we tend to take their testimony very seriously as, you know, evidence that perhaps we should have similar commitments. You know, we don't necessarily sign up for them, but we tend to give a lot of credit to beliefs that are backed up by serious conviction. And so this idea of genuine conviction, I want to explore, because, you know, we need to be somewhat cautious about our tendency to be so deferential. You know, an assertion of conviction is not the same thing as a genuine conviction, and a genuine conviction is not the same thing as a morally admirable conviction. And so I wanted to get a sense of, you know, what the parameters of, you know, the sort of the respect we should have for the wise being are, and what parameters of respect we should have for people who are serious and sincere about their convictions, but maybe don't meet that, you know, high test of, you know, being truly morally admirable. And so those are the animating interests, and led me to, you know, to explore the relation between conscience, conviction, and civil disobedience.
Well, fantastic. If you'll just indulge me, just if I can ask one more biographical question. So I'm fascinated myself, for what it's worth, with the question of how many people get into philosophy by way of epistemology.
Right.
It seems to me a lot. And as somebody who, in my own work, I'm interested in epistemology and political philosophy. So in describing your introduction to philosophy and getting hooked, there was a lot of talk of, you know, thought experiment-y kinds of things. Was there any particular motivation to most of your work professionally is about moral and legal and political philosophy. Was there any point at which you consciously made a decision to pursue that, despite the fact that what got you into philosophy was, at least it sounds like, it was something in epistemology?
It was epistemology. Well, I don't know that I saw those disciplines or those sub-branches of philosophy or even see them now as being very, you know, there are sharp lines between them. Yeah. You know, one question I raise in the book is whether we can know from our first-person perspective whether we're actually cultivating a genuinely admirable conviction, or whether, you know, just from our first-person perspective, we can't know that, or at least we can't know that for much of the time, that it's, you know, it's really that we're quite fallible when it comes to our moral beliefs. And so I think the interest in epistemology is very much still an animating concern. And I think, you know, the questions about theory of knowledge that I found most pressing were those that related to the normative, how should we live? How should we see ourselves? How much confidence can we have in our moral decisions? And not, epistemology applies to a wider range of topics than just moral philosophy, but it was the moral ones that really right. animated me.
Well, that sounds right to me. So let me ask sort of one more. We'll move now into talking about the book. But let me ask a question that about sort of some animating ideas in the book, because it seems, if I'm reading you right, that there are two kinds of commitments in moral philosophy now, broadly understood, that seem to be in the background for a lot of the book, but sometimes they come into the foreground. And correct me if I'm wrong, of course, but it strikes me that you have in moral philosophy certain Aristotelian commitments on the one hand, and then also certain commitments to a pluralism about values. And at certain crucial, I would say, points in the book, these commitments, I think, do some work for the argument. So could you tell us just a little bit about these broader kinds of commitments that you bring to bear on the topic of the book?
Yeah. So with respect to a moral framework, if I had to pin my colors to a label, it would be Aristotelianism, and it would be virtue ethics that I find the most appealing of the traditional Western theories. I think one idea in Aristotle that is very attractive is that philosophy is something you practice, and morality and virtue, these are practical disciplines, not theoretical disciplines. And there's a tradition that's developing outside Western philosophy, more so in psychology and contemplative neuroscience, that is highlighting the extent to which the practical cultivation of virtue is interrelated with the cultivation of understanding, sort of understanding of the functioning of your own mind and your own body, that, people who practically cultivate integrity and generosity and compassion, they, according to the neuroscience, they tend to have more accurate memories of their experiences. They tend to be more accurate in their assessments of how other people are feeling. I think there's a nice, nice link between how Aristotle saw philosophy and saw virtue, and how a lot of what's coming out of Western science, shows about the cultivation of understanding. So, in a way, it might seem, to some extent, strange that I, sign up for Aristotelianism and virtue ethics, because in part of the book, I do take a few shots at a certain version of virtue ethics, namely one that focuses on the virtuous person. And I'm skeptical about the notion that there could be an ideal of the virtuous person. And my skepticism focuses on the fact that in some presentations, the virtuous person is seen as immutable, perfect, fully embodying all of the virtues. And that leaves out the possibility of moral aspirations to improve morally. And yet I think it's a key piece of being a human being and being a moral human being that you aspire to improve morally. And for many of the great elements of morality, there isn't necessarily an upper limit. There may not be a perfect point of loving kindness or compassion. These might be things that are limitlessly progressive. And so the idea of a virtuous person that embodies all virtue, that restricts the way we can think about virtue and the cultivation of virtue. So I'm in one sense, very friendly to virtue ethics, but in another sense, would criticize some of how, you know, virtue is presented in that tradition. With respect to pluralism, that is the moral framework that I work with when it comes to how we should see value, how we should view our actions. That, you know, I embrace the idea, again, sort of more from classical philosophy, that, you know, human life can be tragic, that we can often act wrongly, that, you know, some of the great goods cannot sit happily together. And that framework, you know, I found quite interesting to work with in thinking about the concept of conscience, because, you know, when we think about conscience, you know, there are lots of ideas that come with it. One is the idea that of a clear conscience, and another is, you know, the idea of a demand of conscience, and both of these are often treated as sort of, you know, a binary, that, you know, if you have a clear conscience, then you've done the morally right thing, all things considered. And so one thing I try to do is to see whether we can have a concept of genuine conscience as moral understanding, but situate it within a framework of moral pluralism. So to have conscience when we can't always get it right, you know, just inescapably we're going to act wrongly sometimes. In that framework, having conscience means being sensitive to the competing values and understanding what our moral responsibilities are, and being gentle with ourselves when it comes to judging how we've behaved. But maybe when we get into the details of the book, I can say more about that.
Sure, let's move then straight away, because this is actually the beginning of the book, where you want to provide an analysis of what you call conscientious moral conviction. And you're very keen in the first chapter and the second chapter, indeed, to make a distinction that I found very interesting and compelling in a way, between conscientiousness and conscience. So why don't we begin there? Can you tell us a little bit about, well, on the one hand, what conscientious moral conviction is all about, and how conscientiousness differs from conscience?
Right. So, you know, this kind of task is always a challenging one, because, you know, these terms, they're cognate terms. They have the same etymology, and they, you know, certainly sound similar. So trying to show that these are quite different things is, you know, an entertaining project. And you know,
you mentioned this in the book. The cognate status of them makes it a little bit tricky to prise them apart. But
right.
Yes, please.
Well, and I invoke the example of rights as an analogy. That you know, in liberal philosophy, there's the concept of rights, possessing rights, and there's the concept of something being right, and those two are cognates. But we've managed, for the most part, to pull them apart. You can have a right to do wrong. You know, so having rights doesn't mean you're doing right. So I try to pull apart conscientious conviction and conscience. And one way to sort of see that this can be an intuitive distinction is to think about, you know, the way we use the term conscientiousness sometimes or often. We do use it descriptively. So, you know, someone can be very conscientious in doing something that has absolutely no value. So the, you know, the secretary who, you know, conscientiously, you know, laboriously fills out each form by hand instead of typing them when that would be much more efficient. That's a use of conscientiousness that we're familiar with. So, you know, conscientiousness as something that's fastidious, pedantic, sincere, serious, someone who's really committed, but could be mistaken about the value of their commitment. And that I want to distinguish from conscience. And conscience, I understand not descriptively, but evaluatively. It has a moral, a positive moral valence. And this too has some common sense, ordinary language, you know, support for it. One being, you know, some of those other terms, those phrases that go with conscience that I mentioned, like a clear conscience, a demand of conscience, answering to conscience. You know, these are lofty ideas, and the book, you know, I try to show that there's important work that each of these concepts can do in how we think about people and how we respect people, but they are quite different things.
Right. So, and then employing that distinction in talking now about conscientious conviction, you offer an analysis of these different elements of what conscientious conviction is. Can you tell us a little bit about about that?
Yeah. So, in my view, to have a conscientious conviction, you have to do more than just act in the way that you think you ought to act. You have to, in addition, judge yourself and other people by a common moral standard. So you have to believe that it's wrong not only when you engage in a certain type of conduct, but when anybody engages in that conduct. So if you think it's wrong to eat meat, you have to think it's wrong when anyone eats meat. And, you know, it's a pro tanto wrong, not a all things considered wrong. So that's the first additional element. The two other additional elements which distinguish my view from those you'll find in the literature, and actually there aren't many analyses of conscientious conviction in the literature, but the two additional elements that I think are important but under-acknowledged are non-evasion and dialogic effort. So in my view, to have a sincere conscientious conviction about something, you know, moral conviction, you have to be willing to be seen to hold the view you have. You have to not try to evade the possible repercussions of your view. And you also have to be willing to try to engage other people in deliberation about the merits of your view. You have to be willing to communicate your reasons for holding your view. And, you know, partly that's because in communicating at the level of reason, you show that you believe your view is sufficiently credible that it can be given arguments in its defense. And through the communicative effort, you also confirm your non-evasiveness, your willingness to be seen. And the picture that's on the cover of the book sort of embodies this idea of conscientious conviction. With, you know, the principle that I've given for this idea of conscientious conviction is the communicative principle of conscientiousness. And the picture on the cover of the book is it has a painting by Norman Rockwell called The Jury, which was on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post in 1959. And in this scene, you know, you have 11 men and one woman in a jury room, and you know, there's smoke in the air, and you know, the people, you know, the men have shed their jackets, and you have this image of tension. And in this picture, the woman is sitting in a chair, and she's surrounded by 10 of the 11 men, and you can see that they are united in opposition against her. And then there's one man who's just sleeping at the side of the room, not engaged at all. Mm-hmm. And the woman, she has a straight back. She has her arms folded. She's got this strong look on her face. And you can see she's entirely alone. She's exposed. And she's the dissenter. She's the, you know, the holdout. And in that willingness to be seen, and through her attentive look and engagement, you can see she's also trying to communicate. That embodies a lot of the, you know, what I've called the communicative principle of conscientiousness. And there's a strong visual contrast between her and the man who's sleeping to the side. He might well agree with her, but he's not exposing himself. He's not trying to engage in discussion. So that's my picture of conscientious conviction, and it contrasts with one that sees conscientious conviction as a much more modest, personal, private type of activity. In my view, that kind of activity, it raises a doubt about the person's sincerity. If you're not willing to be seen, if you're not willing to expose yourself and bear the potential risks of dissenting, can we really take your conviction seriously?
Right. One thing that I found very striking about the Norman Rockwell painting, the book, folks, the book opens with a discussion of this painting. It's very striking, is the distribution of the crumpled up pieces of paper, which I take are jury votes, which are all at her feet in a way. There's nothing going on with the guy on the other end of the photo who seems to be falling asleep. It's sort of maybe they have thrown their votes at her in a way.
That's right.
It's a really, really marvelous painting. And a very suitable image for the kind of view you have about conscientious conviction. Let me move then. One of the sort of main moves in the book is show that practices of civil disobedience, as you understand them, are more defensible and maybe in certain cases much more worthy of our admiration or respect or maybe even esteem than what we might think of as or was commonly thought of as conscientious objection, this sort of personal objection. In this respect, you say in the book that you're going to reverse a familiar liberal picture, which regards the conscientious objector as engaging in a noble project of being authentic or true to herself, and the civil disobedient as somebody who's probably taking things too far or might be on the verge of being a fanatic or in some other way is doing something that's very questionable, unlike the conscientious objector. So you've got a couple of arguments that are supposed to vindicate the civil disobedient. And in this regard, one of those arguments you call the conviction argument. Can you tell us about the conviction argument and how it vindicates or puts a more positive gloss on the civil disobedient?
Sure. So the standard liberal view, and you know, in a way, it's unfair for me to lump Rawls and Raz and you know Singer and all these people who've had liberal positions all together, but there is a somewhat common consensus that civil disobedience is a strategic act and that it's aimed at changing the law. It's a deliberate breach of law that is communicative and is granted to, you know, it's acknowledged as conscientious in the liberal literature, but it's not on a par with personal conscientious objection. And this is treated in different ways. So, you know, John Rawls, he wants to make a case for civil disobedience, but he does it by taking a very narrow view of what can count as civil disobedience and a very narrow view of when it's justifiable. So for Rawls, to engage in civil disobedience, your act has to be public in the sense that you warn authorities in advance that you're going to break the law. It has to be nonviolent. It has to be civil or conscientious. And it has to be done with a fidelity to the legal system. So someone like Gandhi was not engaged in civil disobedience because he was a revolutionary. He did not have a fidelity to the British system in India. And someone like Nelson Mandela was not engaged in civil disobedience because he advocated constrained forms of violence like sabotage. And many others, you know, whose acts we might think are civilly disobedient, people who hold sit-ins in government buildings in order to protest the Iraq war, or people who release animals from research laboratories and then, you know, publicize it afterward, they're not civilly disobedient for Rawls because they didn't warn authorities in advance. So, you know, he has this very narrow view of what it is, and then a narrow view of when it's justified. It has to respond to a substantial injustice. It has to be taken as a last resort, And it has to be done in coordination with other minorities. Only then can you say you're engaged in justifiable civil disobedience. Now, that's the best known of the liberal views. Joseph Raz has a broader picture. He doesn't restrict civil disobedience as narrowly as Rawls does. And he has a broader picture of justifiability, but he too argues that, you know, if we were to try and defend a practice of conscientious disobedience, if we were going to try and argue that there is a right, a moral right, to engage in these practices, we will be able to make a stronger case for personal, private disobedience than for civil disobedience. And the reasons relate in part to the risks of civil disobedience. Right. That, you know, this can be seen as, you know, an activity that would inspire other people to break the law, people who are less committed, less serious. It can be seen as, you know, improperly flouting the law, particularly in a liberal society where, you know, if there are decent ordinary channels for participation, you should be using those. You shouldn't be resorting to breach of law. So, you know, this is sort of the liberal picture. And the thing that I argue is that if indeed sincere conscientious conviction is as I've described it, that it requires non-evasion and communicative effort, then breaches of law, like civil disobedience, which are communicative and non-evasive, they have a better claim to the protections that liberal societies tend to give to conscientiousness. You know, liberal societies tend to be respectful, when possible, of demonstrations of sincere conviction. And, you know, and some of that stems from a respect for competing views of the good life, for, you know, the plurality of values that people can espouse. And, you know, my thought is that private conscientious objection that doesn't seek to engage others in deliberation has less of a claim to the protections of conscientiousness. Because, well, first of all, there's this lingering epistemic worry about the sincerity of a private objector, specifically an evasive objector, and there's the loss of benefit to the society. This person isn't trying to support or promote something that they claim they think is very valuable. So the conviction argument rests, you know, in large part on my account of sincere conscientiousness, and defends civil disobedience as the practice that best reflects sincere conviction.
Excellent. So I guess one sort of quick question, if I could follow up, about the sort of the requirement or the aspect of civil disobedience that is aimed at invoking or provoking, maybe might be the better word, a kind of discourse or dialogue with one's fellow citizens. What if somebody thinks that one's fellow citizens are, in a way, hopeless,
right.
or hopeless, maybe are too far gone, or are so blind to what's plainly unjust that more talking or engagement is a kind of inefficient use of one's time. I mean, I'm wondering if just there aren't cases in which someone might say that the more personal disobedience, the conscientious objection stuff, might be the appropriate reaction if one thinks that the dialogical aims of the civil disobedient are, in a way, silly or foolish or so if people are so far gone, there's nothing to do but try to not be complicit in what they're doing.
Right. Yeah. So I guess the thought would be that, you know, the private conscientious objector has decided that, you know, that she can't wait for, you know, there to be enough public discussion that people realize the laws should be changed, she's going to, you know, follow her own sense of what is right, and really maybe has good reasons for thinking that, you know, a change in law is presently unrealizable. I think there's a valid concern there. One point would be that when you engage in civil disobedience, you aren't necessarily addressing your government. Gandhi, who I very much would say was a civil disobedient, was not addressing British rulers in India. You know, he was addressing, you know, the local people of India, and he actually had a very inclusive view of the people he was addressing. So, you know, he said, you know, we cannot ignore the untouchables. We have to, you know, every person can be part of this non-violent, non-hating resistance of, you know, the domination of British rule in India. So, you know, your audience can be, you know, the citizens within your community. Your audience can also be the international community. You know, if you find that there's, you know, there's just no one at home receptive to your efforts, that then, you know, you may have to try and garner support from outside. You know, Mandela and, you know, Oliver Tambo, you know, Oliver Tambo did a lot of recruiting, or, you know, of sympathy and support for the ANC and the anti-apartheid cause, and you know, that was in a way to help build up support at home. So there's, you know, I think you have to be, you know, in a way it's a different request to say you have to try to engage as much as possible with as many people as possible. That's a different request from saying, you know, you have to wait for a better season. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. was very frustrated by white Christian ministers and you know, the local community, who said to him, wait for a better season. You know, they should have been on his side. He said, you know, you share these values, you should be supporting it. So, you know, when you're going to engage in civil disobedience, you have to, there has to be a set of constraints, you know, or, you know, there has to be quite a rich set of expectations of just how hard you're going to try before you resort to more questionable practices. And I'm not thinking here of private objection. I'm thinking of sort of, you know, more radical protest, or the use of deliberately coercive measures, or more extreme violence, that you have to have exhausted, you have to try the other options a lot more than you know, perhaps you might think you'd have to, before you could even contemplate stepping outside constrained breaches of law.
Okay, that's very helpful. The second sort of arm of the argument, apart from the conviction argument, is the conscience argument, where you deploy the conscience argument to defend what you call conscience-driven disobedience. Can you tell us about that second line of argument?
Sure. So the I should just say first that the conviction argument does not focus on the value of a person's belief. So in principle, the conviction argument can be made on behalf of bigots and xenophobes and neo-Nazis, and, you know, think of whatever sort of intolerant, anti-liberal position you like. The conviction argument starts with this thought about what it is to be sincere in your beliefs, and then argues that we have to think about what it is to be autonomous feeling beings who are capable of deep beliefs. So, you know, underlying the conviction argument is a commitment to a principle of humanism, that society and the law must recognize that it's part of our dignity, part of our autonomy, that we are able to cultivate deep and sincere convictions, you know, possibly mistaken convictions, but it's part of being reasoning, autonomous, feeling beings that we can have deep convictions. And it's part of having deep convictions that we try to express them and try to be seen to be holding them. So the conviction argument and the case it tries to make in support of civil disobedience, it actually is very inclusive. And that's one way in which my view differs from a lot of liberal positions, most notably Rawls. You know, Rawls says that, civil disobedience, certainly the only kind of civil disobedience we should try to accommodate is going to be civil disobedience that's in response to substantial injustice. And I want to argue with conviction argument that we should consider protecting some civil disobedience that is animated by injustice. And my argument really lies on this humanistic principle of respect for autonomy and dignity. So that's the conviction argument. And the conscience argument is much narrower.
Right.
This focuses on the civil disobedience that is genuinely morally responsive. So this argument is not available to xenophobes and bigots and people who are intolerant of others' views. It's not even available to misguided do-gooders. It's available to people who have cultivated a moral sensitivity and responsiveness that is informing their breach of law. So the people that I have in mind here, would be people like Gandhi and Aung San Suu Kyi, that they embody this wise integrity, this practical set of moral skills, which is animating their breach of law. So the conscience argument, it's much stronger and much narrower, and the book is framed to bring out these two arguments, the conviction argument and the conscience argument, in moral terms. And then that's in part one. And then in part two, to use each of those arguments to support a distinct legal defense for civil disobedience. So the conviction argument supports an excusatory defense, what I've called the demands of conviction defense, and the conscience argument supports a justificatory defense, the necessity defense. And we'll probably get into that a bit more. But I just say a little bit more about conscience. So in the book, I flesh out what conscience is, and then I try to link it, or to show how it's linked to a certain understanding of our moral responsibilities, that once we've cultivated a fairly nuanced and sophisticated set of practical moral skills, we will appreciate the kinds of moral responsibilities we have in virtue of our distinctive moral roles. And in the third chapter of the book, I try to show that this picture has significant implications for the way that public officials should look at their offices. I argue that when executing the functions of your office, and this can include, our position as citizens, not just, official, standing of prosecutors or police or soldier and so on. But when thinking about our official expectations that our state and society have of us, we have to think of them in relation to the underlying moral roles, moral responsibilities that animate and legitimate those offices. And so when there's a tension between what's demanded of us officially and the moral responsibilities that underline and legitimate the office, we should privilege the underlying moral responsibilities. And so one example I give in the book is, it's quite a sad one, of two community support police officers in the UK who saw a child drowning in a pond, and instead of jumping into the pond to try to save the drowning child, they radioed for an expert rescue team to come to the scene.
Right.
And of course, in the intervening time, the child died. And they were praised by their superior for following proper procedure, but they were censured by UK society, and indeed by former Home Secretary David Blunkett, who said that, you know, rescuing the child, jumping in to save the child, this is what would be reasonable to expect of someone as a human being, you know, never mind the job.
Right.
And the picture I would, or the view I would take of that was, in addition to it being appropriate, you know, just for a human being to respond this way, these were also, you know, they were community support officers whose underlying moral responsibilities were to, you know, sort of take care of their community, to protect the interests of the people in their community. And so in addition to it being just the natural human response to try to save the child, they had special responsibilities as community support officers to try to rescue the child, never mind the rule book. I try to use the concept of conscience and moral understanding to show, you know, that actually when we're looking at the moral expectations of us, we have to engage in a lot of first order moral reasoning. We cannot defer to formal demands.
Right. So that's very helpful. Let's move then to the what you had foreshadowed a few moments ago about the sort of legal dimensions to this, which is the second part of the book, because you do run the conviction argument and the conscience argument wind up becoming or playing a role in two different kinds of legal defenses. One is the demand, as you say, the demands of conviction defense for civil disobedience, and the other is the necessity defense. Can you sketch those moves for us?
Right. So the demands of conviction defense. My thoughts on this started in a response to some work done by Jeremy Horder, who has a book called Excusing Crime. And in the book, he fleshes out what he calls the demands of conscience defense. But because of the special way I'm understanding conscience, I've distanced myself from his terminology. But he does mean what I'm calling the demands of conviction defense. And what he argues is that, you know, the state the state asks too much when it asks us always to put the law first. And he thinks that, you know, a proper respect for private conviction means that you should be able to offer an excuse when you breach the law in some cases. Now, he does not think this argument, that this defense applies to civil disobedience. He thinks it only applies to a very limited set of private acts of objection. But it was his thought about, you know, a legal excuse based on conviction that got me started. And my claim is that, first of all, civil disobedience is the more likely candidate for a practice that can claim this defense because it has better claims to the language of conscientiousness. And I offer additional arguments for why this defense makes sense. So the first argument appeals to autonomy. And, here Horder and I are in agreement to some extent, though part of my story is that autonomy is expressive. Autonomy is communicative. And respecting full autonomy means respecting our need to express and be seen when we have deep beliefs. But that's one argument for the defense, a respect for autonomy and an appreciation that society and the law place overly heavy burdens on us when they ask us always to privilege the law before our personal commitments. The other argument I offer, and this goes beyond Horder, it appeals to the psychological costliness of disregarding our personal commitments. So it's related to autonomy, but it's sort of one step earlier in the story, that in order to have autonomy, we have to have a certain psychological integrity, the capacity to have commitments. And it's in the interests of the state and the law to make some space for our privileging of our commitments, because if that's not there, then we may face, you know, the threat of akrasia, weakness of will, that we won't be able to give priority to the law in cases where it would be appropriate for us to give priority to the law. We'll find it hard to follow the good laws as well as, you know, the laws, or, you know, the, following any law will become more difficult for us. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, this links to an Aristotelian idea, one that Gerald Postuma has discussed, which is that, you know, the cultivation of, you know, reasoning ability and judgment, these have to be exercised. And so if the law always demands that we put the law first and, you know, sort of follow its reasoning without reflection or judgment, that in a way we're dulling our capacities to reason. And that's not in the interest of a liberal democratic society. A liberal democratic society benefits when its people are reflective and responsive and independent-minded about their judgments. So those are the two main arguments for the demands of conviction defense: it's, you know, protection of autonomy and respect for our psychological integrity.
Right. And what about the necessity defense?
So the necessity defense, this was interesting territory for me to explore, because you know, I'm familiar with the fact that civil disobedience have a notoriously difficult time arguing necessity. And it was only in, you know, exploring the literature on the necessity defense that I realized that that problem is not unique to civil disobedience. That's a problem about the necessity defense, that there's a lot of skepticism in the Anglo-American tradition and in, you know, in the courts and by judges about necessity as a defense for breach of law. So there are different accounts of, you know, what you are claiming when you assert the necessity of your breach of law. Some accounts say that you're arguing that your act is the lesser of two evils, you know, that it would have been worse had you not acted. Other accounts, you know, frame it more in terms of sort of the moral, you know, the involuntariness of the act. You know, there's a compulsion element, that you couldn't have done anything but this act. And the account of necessity that I found most interesting in the literature, though ultimately I ended up disagreeing with it, was one advanced by Ian Dennis, where he argues that we really should take a pluralistic view of necessity, that, you know, there are many different dimensions to necessity, and there are actually many different defenses in the law that have a necessity element in them, even if they don't go under that heading. So self-defense, third-party defense, public defense, you know, there's greater recognition of medical necessity, duress of circumstances. These are all domains in which there's a necessity element, but they aren't always given that label. And so he says that there's a family of defenses here that we can call necessity defenses. And I found that quite attractive, but I disagreed with Dennis when he narrows the kinds of concerns that could animate necessity to dangers and emergencies where there's a risk of death or very serious injury. And in my view, that takes into account, you know, some important realms of necessity, but it ignores a more humanistic picture of our needs. So, you know, humans, we have needs not just to be protected from serious injury and risk of death, but we also have needs to be recognized, needs to be, you know, politically recognized, and to be respected as persons, to have our political freedoms honored, not to be subject to the domination of someone else. And so the account of needs-based necessity that I flesh out and say, this is what, you know, if you're acting in civil disobedience in support of this, you know, you can make this case. These needs are it's a richer set, a more pluralistic set, but it's also a more humanistic picture of our needs. And so my argument is that, you know, when someone's acting in civil disobedience in defense of these types of needs and our, you know, essentially our basic human rights, they can argue necessity. So just to give one example, you know, prisoners, people who are long-term prisoners, people held in solitary confinement, people who are, you know, life prisoners, it's in their interests often to be as compliant as possible. You know, to engage in acts of protest in prison is not in your interest. And, you know, there's a bit of an irony there that you sort of show that you're best able to rejoin society and to you know, contribute as an active, reflective participant by being as, you know, passive and as submissive as you can. But for those kinds of people, you know, where there's few opportunities for them to defend their own rights, assert their rights, to engage in civil disobedience in support of their rights, you know, for example, in support of the right not to be subjected to extremely cruel, degrading, or inhumane treatment, that would be a kind of civil disobedience that could plead necessity, in my view.
Right. And so together, these arguments come together in the claim that there is a kind of moral right to civil disobedience. And the book closes with a really fascinating claim that along with the moral right to civil disobedience, there is a moral right to not be punished for it. Could you tell us about that? Because I found that, very, very interesting and provocative.
Yeah. So the idea of a moral right to civil disobedience, this in its general form, this comes out of the idea of a moral right to conscientious action. Right. And so and that indeed comes out of the idea of a moral right to expression. So we have moral rights to express ourselves, and part of that includes action that's expressive of our conviction. And, you know, hopefully the story leading up to that point shows why acts expressive of our conviction have to include some suitably constrained communicative breaches of law. So we get civil disobedience, and we have, you know, hopefully I've shown that there's a moral right, a general moral right to engage in civil disobedience. The moral right against punishment flows somewhat naturally from that, in that the way I understand a right of conduct is that it provides defeasible protection against all forms of interference. So to say you have a right to engage in civil disobedience, a moral right, means, amongst other things, that you have a right to be protected in that activity. You have a right not to be interfered with during the course of that activity, and a right not to be punished for it subsequently. Now, in saying that, I'm not saying that you have a right not to be judged. You know, when we say that we have a moral right to free speech, we don't mean that then people cannot criticize us for what we say. We mean that they cannot prevent us from speaking. And so the same goes for the moral right to civil disobedience and the right against punishment, that you are not immune to criticism, but you are protected from legal interference. And that view, sort of two things to note. One, you know, it is a moral right that I'm talking about, and moral rights are different from legal rights, and it is a defeasible right. So it could well be that in some situation, you know, that moral right is trumped, is overridden by other rights or by, you know, more pressing general concerns. But if that happens, then the civil disobedient really is owed an apology and perhaps compensation. You know, it might seem strange for the state or for a judge to be apologizing, you know, to a civil disobedient for punishing them, but that is sort of the appropriate response, you know, given that there is this moral protection. And there's some, you know, there are some interesting cases in interesting court cases where judges have tried to honor a certain respect, or to show a certain respect for civil disobedience. So judges who have deliberately praised the characters of campaigners, and especially you know, there's one case where the jury found a set of environmentalists guilty for planning to commit vandalism in a coal plant, and the judge praised the campaigners' characters and imposed non-custodial sentences. So, tried to signal that, you know, the jury had made their decision, that was fine, but that this was a very different type of activity from ordinary offending. This was one that deserved respect, and indeed, you know, from the looks of it in the judge's eyes, quite, you know, should not have been punished. So the in a way, the story about the right against punishment, it is derivative of the broader picture about the moral right to engage in civil disobedience.
Right. Well, Kimberly, you've given us a lot of your time, and the book is really, really great. So I congratulate you on it, and I recommend it very, very strongly to everybody who I run into who has interest in these issues. Last question: what's next? Where are you off to next in your thinking?
So the work you know, that I've done on civil disobedience, I think one of my underlying interest is in it's in communication, and it's in sociability. What are our duties as citizens? What are our duties as people when we interact with each other socially? And so my current project I'm working on a book that's provisionally titled No Entry: the Evils of Social Deprivation. And one of the core ideas there is that we have a human right against social deprivation. And when I'm talking about social deprivation, I'm not talking about economic deprivation, you know, like poverty and you know, need for basic subsistence and so on. I do mean social deprivation, that there's an unacknowledged human right against a persisting lack of minimally adequate opportunities for decent human contact. And you know, it's been a really interesting project so far, because you know, it's one of those claims that some people think is absolutely obvious and in a way trivial, and other people think is completely I think one person described it as creepy. And you know, and I think, you know, the one worry is that this is potentially very illiberal. That right. You know, to say we have social human rights, so you know, what exactly does that demand of people? Because social resources are special. They're not like economic resources or even political resources, where you're not requiring anything of individuals personally. But to say we have a human right to decent opportunities for social interaction, somebody has to be providing that. Right. And so, you know, one answer to this worry is a fairly standard move to say that, well, governments are primary duty bearers when it comes to human rights. And so for someone who lacks opportunities incidentally, you know, someone who's disabled or someone who's elderly and who's unable to remedy their social isolation, governments can provide regulated social contact. It also, you know, in focusing on governments as primary duty bearers, allows us to say that governments themselves should not be engaging in practices that are socially privative. So, you know, solitary confinement as a method of punishment, that is a human rights violation on this picture. And the use of detention, certain types of detention in immigration facilities. You know, the U.S., there many people are held in isolation who have not been convicted for a crime. It's not a method of punishment, but just a method of segregation and control. That is also a human rights violation. So this starting idea, I'm hoping to flesh out into a broader account of the ethics of sociability. What are our social duties to each other? What social rights can we assert? What is the general value of sociability? What are the virtues of sociability? And there's, you know, there's overlap with discussions about the ethics of care. But this picture, the ethics of sociability, it's not distinctly relationship based. It's a broader picture of, you know, what do we owe each other socially?
Well, that sounds very exciting, and I'll keep an eye out for work on that. I see that you've already had a paper appear recently. I'm forgetting the journal on some of this on social deprivation. So I'll keep an eye out for more, and maybe we'll have you back if you are willing to talk about that when the book comes out.
Thanks.
New Books in Philosophy. But for now, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you, Bob. I appreciate the discussion.
All right. Take care now.
Bye.
You've been listening to my interview with Professor Kimberly Brownlee of the University of Warwick. We've been talking about her new book, Conscience and Conviction, The Case for Civil Disobedience, published by Oxford University Press. I'm Robert Talese, your host. This is New Books in Philosophy. Thank you for listening.